Hey everyone, and welcome to episode 305 of the Risky Business Podcast. My name's Patrick Gray. On this week's show, can you have your cake and eat it too? Is it possible to build a usable instant messenger platform that is secure and immune to traffic and metadata analysis? We'll be speaking with international man of mystery, the Gruk, all about creating a platform that ticks all those boxes. And as it turns out, it can be done. So goodbye to Yahoo, MSN, AOL and Skype, and hello to something completely new. This week's show is brought to you by Tenable Network Security, and in this week's sponsor interview, we chat with Jeffrey Mann of Tenable about why using point-to-point encryption to dodge PCI scope is a shitty idea. All that is coming up a little bit later on, but first of all, it's time for a check of the week's news headlines with our good buddy, Adam Boileau. And Adam, it turns out the alleged head of Silk Road, Ross Ulbricht, aka Dread Pirate Roberts, if the charges brought against him are in fact true, turns out he really sucks at killing people.
Yeah, according to the allegations made justifying his being denied bail, he attempted to murder six people, none of whom apparently have actually turned up dead. But yeah, more than the original two we were told about in the last couple of weeks. But yeah, he does appear, as you say, to suck at murdering people.
Look, if you can't trust a hitman on an anonymous marketplace, who can you trust?
Well, exactly, and that's one of the funny things here is he apparently paid a guy affiliated with the Hell's Angels biker gang to whack someone, and then this guy, you know, whether or not he actually whacked someone, we don't really know, then claims that, you know, under duress, the person who was about to be whacked implicated a bunch of other dudes, and would he like those killed too? And he took an extra payment of something like $500,000 worth of bitcoins to go whack them, which, you know, I think clearly the Hell's Angel guy is, he knows how to do business in this marketplace.
This is what happens when middle-class educated people try to do crime. This is what happens.
Exactly, yeah. We're not very good at it, are we?
And they're like, oh my God, these people have no honor? What the hell, you know? It's great. The story Kim Zetter has run on this has a great photo with it, with nine of Ross Ulbricht's IDs, including a New South Wales driver's license from Australia.
I did see, yeah. For Sean Angus McCall of New South Wales. Yeah. And the photo looks a lot like Dread Pirate Roberts.
Yeah, we know he spent some time in Australia, right? So it kind of makes sense. He's got a UK driver's license there as well. But yeah, look, the plot is certainly thickening there, and it looks like the brief may in fact be quite thick. Apparently family and friends did pledge $1 million in bail for him. Not that it did him any good because, apparently he's like, been trying to kill a lot of people. And there's going to be a $500,000 legal defense fund launched so he can actually get a defense. So I think it's going to be an interesting trial. I kind of hope that he pleads not guilty so that we get to see the full case and all sorts of wonderful things. Kim Zetter also has a fantastic piece up on the Threat Level blog all about how the feds actually took down Silk Road, which is much as we expected, by sort of infiltrating, working their way up, busting various drug sellers and, you know, flipping them and just working their way to the top.
Yeah, it is an interesting read. It looks like they turned one of the site maintainers, one of the guys who had some level of admin access, and kind of used that, as you said, to work their way up. But yeah, it's an interesting read, and Kim's done a good job of kind of pulling together all the various threads. So yeah, some lunchtime reading for the listeners.
I got to say, like, all of the lead stories in this week's news segment do come from Wired. They did a really cracking job last week writing some really interesting stories. One of them is that the law that allows authorities in the US to conduct breathalyzer tests are kind of being used by the NSA to justify email spying, like email metadata spying. They're like, oh, well, you know, this obviously applies to this because reasons.
Yeah, it's quite funny, really. They've released an 87-page opinion document from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court justifying some of the surveillance activity from about 2004, and it does draw upon such bizarre things as the fact that they can stop you and breathalyze you without any reasonable suspicion for drink driving, and also drug testing of athletes and railroad workers and other kind of things that you do to sort of attempt to prevent crime before it happens. So that's I guess it's an opinion that they've used, but it does seem to kind of stretch things a bit, especially when they also tied it back to the original justification for call metadata wiretapping or call metadata recording from, you know, like a case in 1978 in which someone's purse got snatched, which we've talked about that previously. But yeah, it's very heavily redacted, of course, like all of the information that we're getting about this. So I don't, you know, if I was an American, I guess I would be kind of pissed off about it, you know, the amount that is redacted out of this discussion.
Mm. Yeah, you're stretching, NSA. Try Pilates instead, you know. Now, oh, look, some pretty bad news for the anonymous hacktivist Jeremy Hammond. I mean, we haven't really focused much on his plight because, you know, we've been waiting for the sentencing. But the sentence has come down and he's been sentenced to 10 years in the clink, which... In my mind, I mean, I don't think that hacking Strat4 personally, it's my personal belief that hacking into Strat4 and dumping their mail and stealing all their credit card info isn't really legitimate political activism. I don't, you know, think that it is legit. At the same time, I think that this is a crazy sentence to pass on a young guy who, you know, in his mind was engaged in civil disobedience. I mean, this is going to ruin his life.
Yeah, well, yeah, clearly it is in the middle of ruining his life right now. And it does seem like rather a harsh sentence, you know, 10 years in jail for, you know, what they're talking, they're alleging between $1 and $2.5 million worth of losses, you know, plus the fact that, you know, he owned Strat4 and broke a few laws in the process. You know, it does seem like quite a lot. But then, you know, we were talking about this around the office earlier on today here, and Pipes made a good point, you know, well, you know, LulzSec were all about rubbing, you know, the FBI's and the law enforcement's nose in things. And if you, you know, if you hack the FBI and make fun of them, right, you're going to have a bad time when it comes to sentence. And I think that's, you know, that does seem to be probably what's going on here.
Yeah, but if he was a Brit, you know, I mean, if he, assuming extradition failed, he would have had to wear a bloody anklet, you know, for a few months, and that would have been that. I mean, look, given he is a recidivist, he'd been convicted for other stuff previously, but this just seems nuts. And I mean, it's always these types of activists, these people who are so passionate about their beliefs, who eventually grow up, moderate, and become really important contributors to the sort of political discussion out there. So... I just think this is a shocker. I mean, 10 years, mate. I mean, you get less for killing someone in a lot of places.
Well, yeah, and certainly by comparison with some of the other sentences we've seen handed down to other LulzSec people in the UK, you know, Topia and Ryan Cleary in the UK, they were much less severe. And I'm sure they, you know, you read some of Hammond's backstory, and I mean, they're not, you know, he's arrested for like marijuana possession and stuff. Like, they're not, you know, not exactly massive crimes. I mean, describing him as a, you know, recidivist, I suppose, does seem a bit, you know, makes it sound grander than it is. But yeah, it does seem pretty harsh to me.
No, he actually was convicted in 2006 for hacking a right-wing group's website and stealing credit card numbers. So they weren't using drugs charges against him. He was a recidivist when it came to computer crime. But, you know, I mean, this guy won't be eligible for parole until 2021. And, you know, personally, I just think that's a travesty. And as I say, I don't even support what the guy did. You know, I think he's you know, just a fairly typical Anon, pretty radical activist. But... yeah, I'm not down with that sentence. But anyway, some people who probably do deserve a little bit of time in the pound me in the ass. There's been five more people charged to do with this $45 million global cybercrime scheme, according to CNetNews.com.
Yeah, they picked up a bunch of guys from New York who are actually taking money out of the ATMs using, you know, generated ATM cards. Apparently, they had hilariously security camera footage of these guys going from ATM to ATM with backpacks, gradually becoming more heavy with cash.
Yeah.
And they ended up with like $800,000 worth of cash in backpacks and then, you know, handed on to the rest of the organization that was doing this. But yeah, like clearly not the smartest people in this particular conspiracy.
This is the ring where the ringleader was actually murdered in the Dominican Republic back in April. We spoke about that at the time, but some interesting stats here. 40,500 withdrawals in 27 countries during two sprees in December and February. So it was one of those, like, hit as many ATMs as you can before they figure out what's going on attacks. And seems like it was pretty successful in getting the cash, but now some dudes are getting busted.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I guess the moral of the story is if someone from Eastern Europe or the Dominican Republic offers you a, you know, a very nice set of, you know, a few dozen ATM cards, maybe don't go make those withdrawals, eh?
Now, turning our attention to some spook news and Snowden leaks, and we've got a number for them now. The chief of the NSA says that Snowden may have actually leaked up to 200,000 documents.
Yeah, that's the number that came out during a speech that he was giving into a foreign affairs group in Baltimore. He said somewhere between 50 to 200,000 documents, which, you know, on the, you know, fairly rubbish metric of number of documents, puts it sort of somewhere in between the you know, Pentagon reports on the Iraq War that were leaked by leaked to WikiLeaks, which was something like what 400,000 versus the 250,000 State Department cables that were leaked. So yeah, it kind of puts it in the same league as that, but clearly, you know, in terms of actual real interest, there is a lot more here, or certainly it's a lot more general than perhaps that we saw from the war logs.
Now, we've often spoken about the vulnerability of BGP to, you know, you just announce a funny route and, you know, routers accept it. It seems that there has been some funny routes announced and a lot of traffic is being redirected. A group of researchers have actually been just watching routing and just seeing all these people playing funny buggers with it.
Yeah, there's this company called Renesis that have been monitoring, you know, routes across the backbone, monitoring BGP tables and things. And they've come up with some examples of actually, you know, real route redirection attacks occurring. And one of the examples they give that look quite interesting is the during February this year, there was a case in which every day of the of February, a different set of networks were jacked and sent off through to Belarus on their way to their destination, and then put back at the end of the day, and then a new set of targets the next day, which does, you know, make it look a little bit more a little less likely than, you know, it being a mistake somewhere, and a little bit more more deliberate. And, you know, this is a thing we, you know, we've, as you said, we've talked about it a number of times in the past, and it's a you know, it's just kind of the way that that BGP, you know, largely has to work. But, you know, it looks like people are, in fact, compromising ISP routers and then, you know, or compromising ISP router management infrastructure and then actually using it to do do these kinds of attacks. And, you know, metrics on this are certainly interesting. But, you know, overall, you know, we've had to learn to not trust the backbone networks to start with. I mean, even more so than now that everything's being sniffed, and rely on PKI to save us. And whether or not that you know, that is a thing that's actually useful, I don't know. But yeah, it's very interesting to see some stats about these attacks actually happening, you know, on the backbone networks.
Well, it just goes to show that if it can be done easily, it is being done frequently, I think. So it's just nice that actually someone sat down and bothered watching routes and just, you know, prepared a little report. I'm surprised it's taken this long for someone to do it and whack out a press release. Now, the speaking of PKI and all things crypto, the EFF has actually released a scorecard which shows, quote, crypto leaders and laggards. It's an interesting idea.
Yeah, it's quite a cool table. I mean, I think the, you know, this is, well, I mean, the table describes essentially the security properties of a number of the big, you know, kind of cloud and internet companies, you know, Google and Facebook and Foursquare and Dropbox and those little people, and rates, you know, whether they do, for example, HTTPS on the front end, whether they support perfect forward secrecy, whether they have HSTS turned on, whether they do start TLS for mail, and kind of compares and contrasts. And, you know, I think these are, you know, this is a useful tool to pressure some of the organizations that, you know, do need to do better, you know, about the fact that they are lagging behind other people. I mean, for example, Microsoft shows up rather notably there as not having, you know, encrypted inter data center links, for example, and not supporting HSTS. And I think that's it's a useful tool to pressure people like Microsoft. On the other hand, it's also useful to show that, you know, for example, AT&T and Comcast are on this list and they got nothing. Like, it's all red across their entry. And that's to be expected because the telcos have a very long history of cooperating and, you know, providing access to their internals. So they don't really have any incentive to protect their customers' privacy because that's not the business that they're in. So I think it's a good, you know, it's a good tool to kind of leverage, you know, apply some leverage to the companies that can improve things. You know, overall, it doesn't really take into account the, you know, the much more, you know, complicated reality of all of this, but it's quite a good sort of shorthand, you know, talking point, I think.
Now, also, a group of senators in the United States has criticized the NSA surveillance programs as being unnecessary, which is, you know, seems like a reasonable thing to argue in light of how pervasive the surveillance is.
Three Democratic senators have actually filed amicus briefs on one of the lawsuits that was, you know, coming up against the NSA, you know, against the, you know, challenging the constitutionality of the kind of surveillance that they've been doing. And, you know, seeing politicians like this, you know, kick in has got to be good. But on the other hand, we've seen the Supreme Court reject one of the challenges, the one that was led by the Electronic Privacy Information Center, and basically say that, you know, we're not even going to listen to this case. So, you know, It's difficult, I suppose, with all these the lawsuits going on, and none of them really seem to be going very far, despite this, you know, this kind of level of support.
Well, I can see why the Supreme Court wouldn't want to hear it, because obviously, if you can stop someone and give them a sobriety test, then you can look at all of their emails and their phone calls.
Oh, well, of course.
Because it makes complete sense.
Yeah, it does.
It makes complete sense. Yes. Now, Eric Schmidt of Google. There's two stories that appear next to each other here, which I think are quite funny, because you've got Eric Schmidt coming out and saying that censorship could vanish within a decade. And of course, we're speaking to the Gruck after the news, all about the idea that we could actually have anonymous and secure messaging platforms, for example. So it doesn't seem such a out there proposition that we could see censorship vanish within a decade. What makes this interesting, though, is the very next story, also on CNET, has Vint Cerf saying privacy may be an anomaly and we're all giving up privacy. So it seems like the left hand and the right hand at Google maybe not that in tune with each other.
It is quite funny. And the thing is that they both do have points, but the core issue here is one of them is about, private communication between people, and the other is about public communication, right? And necessarily public communication is public. And of course, Vint Cerf saying, privacy is an anomaly. Well, that's true in communications where, it's broadcast and you're talking to everybody on, on Twitter. But on the other hand, the Schmidt is talking about the fact that we can use, crypto, and we can use, technical means to limit communications, the visibility of communications between individuals. And I mean, the two, it's stupidly juxtaposed being next to each other like this on CNET. But, it's funny because they are talking about, kind of different things, even though, as you say, they're both, left-hand and right-hand from the same Google.
Yes, yes. Well, Yahoo's doing its bit.
About fucking time, right?
Yahoo is apparently giving users the option to use SSL on all its web properties, and you totally know all of their users are going to go and enable that because they always think about it, right?
They do, right? Because, Yahoo's user base is totally up with the fucking times.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. See, about time, and to give them their credit, yes, I imagine it is difficult to turn on crypto. It uses lots of extra CPU and you don't have much spare because you're Yahoo, presumably. But and it's interesting. I mean, Yahoo does provide mail services for a lot of other people. For example, the biggest domestic telco here in New Zealand, actually their mail platform is the Yahoo mail platform. So I mean, turning it on across all these different partners, I can see, is a bit difficult. But yes, let's just see when they actually make it mandatory and they do all the rest of the other things that, Google and even Hotmail have managed to do.
Yeah, well, they reckon they're going to encrypt all inter-data center traffic by the end of Q1 2014, and they are going to offer users the option to encrypt all data by the end of Q1 2014. Of course, that should be the default. That's just ridiculous that it's not.
Yeah,
but
it's
a difficult project to stand up. We get that. And they're going to apparently work closely with their international mail partners to ensure that Yahoo co-branded mail accounts are HTTPS enabled. So when you've Yahoo 7 in Australia or whatever, they're going to make sure that, they're using HTTPS. But I reckon, given that you'd be logging into a front-end server for IM and then probably bouncing out to a data center. I mean, that's a whole stream of IM traffic that the NSA just isn't going to get anymore.
Yeah, and I'm sure they'll probably be a bit sad about that, but, Boo sucks.
Oh, dude, mass ownage this week. V-Bulletin. O'Day and V-Bulletin causing all sorts of tears everywhere.
Yeah, there's been some fairly large-scale ownage of both vbulletin.com and macrumors.com. We saw the DEF CON forums also shut down, though it's not clear whether they got owned or whether they're just scared of the fact that there is allegedly vbulletin O'Day. Although, actually, it seems a bit conflicted as to whether or not there really is. Some of the stories seem to suggest that, in actual fact, it's just a compromised admin account on vbulletin.com that was then used to own a bunch of people, own the rest of the site through script injection using a feature rather than a bug. But on the other hand, someone is selling vBulletin 0-day on a forum somewhere for something like $7,000. So we don't really know what's going on, but either way,
I'm kind of tempted. You want to pass the hat around? You could have fun.
Yeah,
with
apparently
that.
Someone has actually bought it. If you go and look at the Bitcoin, global transaction log, you can see that the account where the money is supposed to go has received at least one payment of 15 bitcoins, covering the cost of the vulnerability. But whether they actually got their money's worth, we don't really know yet. But
you got to love the DEF CON image that they put up when they disabled the forums and the wiki. Twitter has a fail whale and they have a super shark fin sad cat, which is hand-drawn by the looks of things in MS Paint. Very nice.
It is. It's a beautiful, beautiful piece of artwork.
It is. Oh, now Cupid Media, which is like, they operate a whole bunch of dating sites. They've been owned. It was part of this. I mean, Brian Krebs is like pulling such a Glenn Greenwald here, right? Because he got that big data dump that it contained all the Adobe stuff, and he's still just milking it because, yeah, there's 42 million creds as a part of this dating site network.
Yeah, 42 million entries with clear text passwords as well as dates of birth and first name, last name, email addresses and stuff. That's a pretty significant breach. It's a fairly vulnerable user base. I mean, in that they're going to be used to getting unsolicited contacts via email probably already. And this is only going to make it worse for them. And yeah, obviously having your dating site account compromised is something that could impact your life in many interesting ways. But I personally actually quite like a copy of that dump because that many clear text passwords is wonderful for your cracking system, but it's not a good look.
Well, it's funny, I actually looked at the Cupid Media website and they seem to specialize in running dating sites in poor countries, which if you look at their success stories seem most to pair up dudes, ugly dudes in their mid-50s with really young poor women, and you just think, I'm kind of okay with you guys getting owned,
I'm sure you're making some generalizations there, but yeah, they do seem
they're their testimonials. You see some 55-year-old dude like with some 21-year-old Indonesian chick, and you're just like, oh my God, that's your business model.
Yeah, it is a pretty seedy looking business model, and they run dozens and dozens of like weird niche dating sites, for whatever thing you're after. And I can see your point there.
Yeah. So now we spoke some time ago about that massive spike in Tor traffic, which turned out to be a malware command and control CNC that was using Tor, which kind of brought them unstuck because then the malware got a lot of attention. I think that botnet actually got wound up. There's a new one which is using I2P, which is kind of interesting. So it seems like we're seeing more and more CNC using things like Tor and I2P for command and control.
Yeah, this one's called iTunes Ninja or something. It's a relatively bog standard kind of Trojan, malware suite. It's interesting because they are using the I2P network, which is sort of a competitor to Tor. It has some slightly different security properties and has some different architectural choices. But it's interesting seeing that it being picked up like this. Maybe this is a mark of success for your mixing anonymization network when it's actually being used for real crime.
Yeah, look, I still think it's sound advice for people operating enterprise gateways out there to just block Tor and to block things like I2P because they have no business in a corporate network.
Yeah, I'd say that's probably pretty reasonable advice, yes.
Mm. Now, GitHub has reset a bunch of users' passwords because there was some brute force attack affecting their users and the ones with dumb passwords got popped.
Yeah, the funny thing about this particular effort is that the person who was brute forcing credentials on GitHub was using 40,000 boxes to do it with, or at least something like 40,000 distinct source addresses to do the brute forcing, which is, you really got to want to own some accounts for that. We were discussing around the office actually whether, the mechanics of actually doing that. And then perhaps the most interesting thing is whether or not they were using, some of the big breaches that we've seen recently, Adobe breach, etc., to generate the targeting list, generate the usernames and passwords and things that they were trying, because that would be, you might have some reasonable success with that. But yes, if you've been getting password reset emails out of GitHub, you should probably consider checking that your password is not crap.
Now, this next story contains some disturbing information that until now I was not aware of, but apparently Netflix uses Microsoft Silverlight. Yay. But there's apparently this exploit kit doing the rounds, which affects Silverlight, and that's going to start popping up everywhere. But holy shit, Netflix, why?
Yeah, I know. Of course, I suppose you have to explain to our American listeners, we don't have Netflix because we're not from America, jerks. And so we don't know anything about your Netflicking or whatever it is that you do with, 60% of the internet traffic. But yes, apparently it uses Silverlight. Who knew? There's a Silverlight bug that was only just recently patched, I think. It's going to own people, I suppose, which not us because we don't have Netflix.
Oh, also, JBoss attacks are up. There'd been some exploit code in JBoss, and surprise, surprise, it's being used.
Yeah, this is a variant on the JBoss kind of RMI management service bug. Though I think it's come up a couple of times because we saw Cisco appliance getting owned for having embedded JBoss relatively recently. Actually, was it HP ProCurve Manager being owned because it had JBoss embedded? So yeah, there's been some new exploit code shown up on ExploitDB, and of course, people are now hammering JBoss everywhere. Which, you know, this is it's such a rubbish bug, and it would be embarrassing to be owned by this. So you should probably go and check. If you've got enterprise Java business going on with your JBosses.
Some interesting Bitcoin news. We should mention too, like I think a week ago, there was some US government hearing where they representatives of the US government said that, you know, Bitcoin wasn't illegal and it's a valid, you know, method of exchange. Bitcoin shot through the roof, so it's like doubly newsworthy at the moment. But a gaming site has actually just settled with authorities because they would... They would give you this anti-cheating client that you had to install to be part of this community. Turns out that it actually used your box to do Bitcoin mining. They made off with something like $3,500, which isn't much. They got a good solid spanking for it, but kind of a lot of trouble for $3,500 in Bitcoin.
It really is. Like, I laughed so hard when I read this. But yeah, like, you'd think, right, if you're going to, you know, if you've got that many people, and something like 14,000 deployments of this thing were mining Bitcoins for them on, you know, on gaming computers that have GPUs, you'd think you'd be able to accrue more than $3,500 worth of Bitcoins. Although, as you said, like, the price has gone up, so maybe it'd be worth a bit more now. But either way, getting spanked by, the regulators in the state of New Jersey, it's got to be, not getting your money's worth out of that.
Now, we've spoken over the last couple of weeks about the continued expansion of bug bounty programs to cover all manner of things. Google has actually expanded its bug bounty program to cover Android bugs, which I guess the most surprising thing about this news is it wasn't covered already. I always assumed it was.
Yeah, well, me too, actually. I'm surprised that because they've paid for bugs in Android before through things like the Pwn to Own program, that sort of thing. But I guess, yeah, now it's a bit more widespread. So if you have bugs in Android, or indeed a great many other pieces of software, because they've Google has been announcing bug bounties all over the internet for various pieces of important software, then you should go cash in.
Very quickly, Google, we spoke about it some time ago. They announced that they were going to deprecate all 1024-bit protected web certs. That process is now finished. Everything is 2048 bits. So, yay, Google, you get a biscuit. Sweet story here in cnetnews.com about the Enigma codebreaker Mavis Beatty. I think the nicest thing about this is, you know, back in the 40s, 30s and 40s, I mean, it was a different time, and I bet it really would have got up Hitler's nose to know that he got owned by a chick called Mavis back then. But she apparently passed away, I think, last week, and there's a nice little profile there on news.com. Apple has released an update for iOS 7.04, which apparently fixes some app purchase store something, I don't know, but just patchy stuff. You'll all be getting at OTA anyway. And some account hijack bugs found in PayPal. Anything interesting here?
I think none of these bugs look particularly exciting. There weren't any details. Obviously, getting a PayPal account compromised, you had a bunch of money, it could be a problem. But nearly all of the bugs were related to PayPal's, like the Chinese front end that they use, because PayPal is expanding into the Chinese market. A number of these bugs came out of PayPal's bug bounty program. They're not paying a whole bunch of cash, but they are paying for bugs, and it appears to be netting them some results. So, chalk up another score for the jug that is, bug bounty programs now.
Yeah, look, I reckon this is great because it's going to draw so much talent into this discipline and industry as well. That's another thing that I really dig about bug bounties. News from SC Magazine, stop presses. There's a fake AV solution out there, which apparently is using stolen certificates. So if you work for Ease Entertainment Services LLC, you got owned and someone is using your crypto to own people with fake AV. VMware has patched a Privesque bug in its workstation solution. And finally, Adam, there's this really fascinating story in Foreign Policy magazine that you sent to me. It's written by Ralph Langner, who was one of the most prominent analysts who really tore apart Stuxnet and did some excellent work on it. He's written this great three-page article about Stuxnet, where he talks about a lot of the stuff that has been missed, chiefly that Stuxnet actually came in two phases. that the second phase was intended to collect information. It was intended to get out there via USB onto the laptops of consultants visiting that facility so that they could collect intelligence on other facilities that they might not previously have known about. And also it was intended to be discovered so that it was like a declaration of cyber dominance. A very interesting take and a good read.
Yeah, very much so. It also has a bunch of details about one of the other payloads that the earlier variants of Stuxnet carried, which was quite a bit more stealthy than the payload we saw in the release, in the version of Stuxnet that was widely discussed. And, you know, that's really interesting. I think if you, if you're in the control system space, it's certainly worth reading, or at least passing on to your colleagues that are in that particular area, because it goes into plenty of detail about exactly what they were doing and how they were doing it, and how you go about doing a low and slow attack on control systems. Systems rather than the slightly more noisy, manipulating the speed controls that we saw in the later payloads.
There is a link to that story in the show notes, and I'm not encouraging anyone to do anything here, but it might be worth mentioning that their paywall...
If there's a paywall in the way and the div is kind of a little bit in your way, you could just remove it out of the DOM tree and then read the article,
Yeah, but we're not suggesting you do that because that would be probably some sort of hideous violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, subject to 20 years in prison. Hello, Americans. But Adam, that is actually it for this week's news. Thank you very much for joining us, and we'll chat to you again next week.
Thanks, Pat. Talk to you then.
Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's news headlines. Adam works for Insomnia Security. He is based out of Wellington, but Insomnia also has a presence in Auckland. And it is looking to hire a senior consultant / pen tester there. So if you fancy a move to Middle Earth and you want to work with guys like Adam, Mark Piper and Brett Moore, let me know. Email me at patrick@risky.biz. And your technical skills need to be pretty mind-blowing, and your resume should back that up if you want to apply for that one. But do get in touch for more info, patrick@risky.biz. Okay, it is time for this week's feature interview now with the Gruk. It turns out all of your instant messages belong to the NSA. Thanks to Edward Snowden, we know this. If they're being sent to the front-end servers in the clear, they're being picked up by XKeyscore. Thanks, Yahoo. If they're SSL to the front-end server, they're still probably being snuffed by Muscular, sniffed off the wire between the data centers of your messaging provider. So clearly there's a market emerging for a secure messaging platform. But that will only get you so far. Metadata traffic analysis still presents massive privacy problems for people with legitimate reasons to hide things, like, I don't know, journalists, for example. It is possible, however, that a platform could be constructed that would take care of the traffic analysis problem and the content encryption problem. I got the Gruk on Skype to find out how you might go about stitching together a platform like this. And we started off by discussing what the latest developments in secure messaging look like.
Pretty much everyone that can type -L crypto at the end of a makefile is now writing their own secure messenger. And as is typical, all of them start out with the problem with messaging is that it's not encrypted. Therefore, we will add encryption and messaging will be solved. And that's f***ing retarded. That's actually the bare minimum you have to be this high to get on the ride level of protection that you need. But it's not a secure messenger simply because it gives you content encryption or content protection. The real problem with all of these messaging systems is, generally speaking, the content is mostly irrelevant.
There is a reason metadata analysis is the interesting thing to intelligence agencies, and that's a problem that's much more difficult to solve than content encryption.
Certainly, like if you look, for example, at the Ryzen affair, where James Ryzen is being done for receiving classified materials from someone working at a think tank based at the State Department.
Who's
in the US.
Who's James Ryzen? Sorry.
He's this reporter.
Is he the Fox guy? Or
yes, he is.
That's yeah, yeah, I know the one, right.
Yeah, okay. So the affidavit for him is absolutely hilarious because as you read through, basically, these guys were using their desk phones to call each other. basically, Ryzen and Kim were communicating via a load of different channels. They had multiple email accounts. They were calling each other from desk phone to desk phone, from desk phone to cell phone to desk phone, back and forth. And throughout the affidavit, there is very, very little content actually used to make the case. Primarily what they do is they say...
I'm guessing what it goes, flurry of communication, leak appears on Fox News. A couple of weeks go by, flurry of communication, leak pops up on Fox News. Is it something like that?
Exactly. Yeah. It'll be like a 30-second phone call, both people leave together, they come back a few minutes apart. Mm. Flurry, like phone call in the morning, 10-minute phone call, the classified data comes out, a 30-second phone call. One of them is particularly hilarious because it's a desk phone to desk phone call that lasts about 3 seconds, and then immediately after it's a desk phone to mobile phone call that lasts almost a full minute. And I can totally just see that Kim calls up Ryzen on his desk phone
and says, call me back from a payphone. Yeah.
Yeah. And Ryzen goes, this isn't safe. Call me on my cell phone.
Yeah.
Immediately just calls back on the cell phone. And of course, the point is, it wasn't safe because it was clearly a communication between the two people. It had nothing to do with, oh my God, our desk phones are being monitored. It has, our desk phones are tied to our identities. You know,
yeah.
Our desk phones are obviously us communicating. That is the problem. So that is what needs to be solved. It's the anonymity of the individuals involved, the metadata, the amount of time that people communicate, who they communicate with, the size of the messages actually can be very interesting. So a short ping versus, you know, here's that 1 megabyte document you wanted, and then a few minutes later, that 1 megabyte document shows up on a link on Fox News.
What about things like CryptoCat, though, where both people SSL in, it's OTR encrypted? I mean, I would have thought that would be a little bit difficult to pin down from a metadata investigation point of view.
It's actually useful to look at CryptoCat because it has changed dramatically. And the current architecture certainly does solve some of the metadata analysis issues. Assuming that
CryptoCat isn't coughing up against warrants, right? Yeah, and that's the problem, is you're required to actually trust the service provider. So in comes some of these newer services, which are like, what's it called? BitMessage, right? Is a messaging protocol based on similar principles to Bitcoin. And I'd looked at the spec at one point and just thought, this isn't going to scale. But I'm not a technologist. You are. Am I right?
You're absolutely right. I mean, The idea that the problem that they're trying to solve was they want to defeat traffic analysis. So they want the messages to go to everyone. That way you can't say.
I read the spec and it looked like a version of Twitter where everybody follows everybody and then you just, you know, and everything's encrypted and you try to unlock basically every message there is. And, you know, if one of them happens to have been encoded with your key, bang, hey, I got my message. But, you know, that might work if there's like 50 people using it.
Yeah, that'll work for the first 1,000 people. And then what happens when you get, you know, if it was ever actually successful, what happens when you get the first 1 million people? Like, your for example, your laptop fan would be running hot enough to, you know, cool the room. It would just be insane. It wouldn't make any sense that you're there decrypting every single message that comes in from 1 million people for the last 4 days.
But is that actually how it works? Is that how it's intended to work?
Yes, that's the theory behind it. And it has other flaws as well. They screwed up on the crypto with version 1. They are assuming that all of the clients are benign. So they part of their threat model was that they didn't include someone would modify the client and actually keep a record of all of the messages ever. So, you know, like they were trying to add, you know, they're defeating the traffic analysis by everyone gets every message from everyone else, which is, as you pointed out, an incredibly horrible idea in terms of being able to protect in terms of being able to scale. And they were trying to add the idea of ephemeral messages. So the blockchain, all of this message data, you only keep for 4 days, right? And that their idea is that this provides security because after the 4 days, is over, your message vanishes and it won't
unless
be there
someone's
anymore.
Logging everything, right? So yeah, I sort of see where you're going with that. Like intelligence agencies have been doing with IRC since forever. What about stuff like TorChat? How does TorChat go?
So what TorChat does is it actually cheats, which is kind of clever. It assumes that all of the protection and encryption is provided by the Tor protocol, because Tor itself actually has layers of encryption. So what you end up with is the person that you are contacting will run a Tor hidden service that is their chat client that's listening. And when you connect to it, you connect to it as your own Tor hidden service. And so the chat basically is encrypted from end to end exclusively by the Tor protocol, which means that the two ends actually don't do any encryption themselves, and they don't need to do any anonymity themselves. So TorChat, I think, is actually a pretty good solution.
Yeah, I was thinking for peer-to-peer, I mean, you're not going to have a buddy list, with TorChat, though, which would probably be the usability drawback there. But from a point-to-point one, I mean, you know, Fox News guy could have used this, right?
It would have been perfect for him. Apparently, it was the application of choice for the admins of Silk Road. And again, it's perfect for a situation where you have a very
that worked out great for those guys, huh?
Well, that wasn't how they got busted. So you have to say, if nothing else, TorChat was not the problem.
Yeah.
Of all of the issues that they had, at least they had a secure messaging solution.
Yeah, well, exactly. That works. Okay, but like if we want to talk about a more traditional sort of IM model where you've got, you know, sort of pseudonyms that I know and that you know, but maybe would be difficult for the man to figure out. I mean, is there anything there that is a more traditional style of instant messenger that can defeat traffic analysis?
So there's Silent Circle, which is pretty good in that. Once again, all of the traffic goes to their servers, and then from there it gets forwarded on to the destination. So it's much harder to do a traffic analysis against that because it goes through some sort of central points. It's basically XMPP plus OTR with a key exchange that's done using ZRTP for some reason.
Yeah.
What you're getting is pretty much the same thing that you'd get with Pigeon plus OTR plus any open source, freely available Java server, only you get it on your phone and you get to pay $120 a year for it.
Yeah,
so,
but I mean...
And the client is quite nice, so you know, there is that.
Well, it's the same problem that we were talking about with CryptoCat, right? Which is if the NSA just decide, well, it's going to be too hard getting a warrant, let's just root their boxes and steal all their metadata or capture it in real time, even if they say they're not logging it, then you're kind of boned, right?
Yes, pretty much. Encryption, but you do lose the... So once again, they don't get the content... But as we've said, they don't really need the content. They just need to know these two people were in cahoots, this communication, and then that thing happened. These are the guys we want.
How do we defeat, apart from coming up with a service provider who we absolutely trust, runs 100% awesome security against state actors and all sorts of attackers, someone who we know is not going to cough up data on warrants. I mean, you know, that service provider basically doesn't exist. Is there any sort of peer-to-peer... TorChat seems a good way to go when you're talking about, you know, a secure communication between two people.
Mm-hmm.
But is there anything we can do which is more like a regular IM client that's going to defeat metadata analysis that does not rely on the integrity of a central authority?
So far, nothing I've seen that's been released has actually solved that. So there's two smaller projects. One of them is called Pond, and one of them is called Cables. Cables is done by the Liberté Linux guy. It's a Russian professor doing a lot of work on what they call liberation technology. He's very, very cool. Cables is not used by anyone, as far as I can tell. And again, it's very, very similar to TorChat. It uses Tor hidden services. It also uses I2P, which is a similar network for it's similar to Tor, except it's completely closed. It doesn't give you access to the internet. And there's also Pond, which is along the same lines. It's being done by a Google guy, the same guy that's rolling out encryption between all of their data centers right now. It looks quite good, but again, you're dealing with it's a hidden service, and it's basically email. It doesn't give you that low latency, hey, how you doing? I'm fine.
Sort of chat
environment. You know, it gives you a secure form of email. Essentially,
I mean, how I'm thinking this could actually evolve, right? I mean, the Tor chat example makes perfect sense, right? From a point-to-point point of view. Could you imagine that someone might actually create some sort of distributed peer-to-peer directory? So I can actually say, this is my hidden service, right? I'm going to announce it with this directory, sort of like a supernode in something like Kazaa. That's how old school I'm getting with this conversation, right?
Okay.
So you sort of announce it, and then people can connect to it. And it's a little bit difficult for law enforcement, well, very difficult, given that it runs over a Tor network, for them to do any traffic analysis because they don't know where to collect.
Right. So you actually, in terms of very, very old school stuff, what you're talking about is a protocol called GNUnet, which has had some life breathed into it of late. It was...
Gee, I wonder why.
all of a sudden, there's interest in things which... So, their adversarial model is actually very, very good. So it assumes that there's a global passive observer, which, you know, we know actually exists. It assumes that there are malicious nodes who are taking part of the network, who are injecting fake traffic, who are not delivering legitimate traffic, who are logging everything that goes through. And it still has a security system that defeats traffic analysis and defeats the sort of metadata analysis that we've been talking about. And
It's like the idea of springing up those sort of hidden service like directories.
Yes, exactly. So it uses distributed hash tables that you can do. They're encrypted, and you can do queries against the encrypted values to get some. It's all quite complicated. I've been looking at trying to write services for it. There's nothing available like Tor. Like Tor, you can roll out a hidden service very, very easily. GNU, the GNUnet, you cannot. However, there is a package on top of it called RetroShare, which is available from SourceForge. It's not very stable. It crashes a lot. It's primarily used for file exchange, but they have been talking about adding a messaging system on top of that.
See, Greg, I can really see, like when I was mentioning the Tor example before, I can really see the Tor project or someone, you know, at the periphery of the Tor project really getting behind that, because in my mind, that's actually a very easy solution just to have those directories. You know, pseudonym, you know, hidden service address, bang, just publish, push it out to the directories. And that does defeat contemporary metadata analysis.
Certainly. If someone were to make Tor chat, like currently the way that Tor chat works is you would have to give me your exact hidden service for me to access you, which is great, you know, if all I ever do is want to talk to you. But as soon as it's multiple people, it falls apart.
But it would be nice, right? If I just published, you know, patrick@risky.biz has this Tor hidden service for chat, you can contact me anonymously and no one can do traffic analysis. I mean, that is actually problem solved, right?
Yes. One of the nice things with Tor chat as well is because it's all in Python, you can actually, if you as Patrick want to have people contact you, you can take the Tor chat Python zip file, like the whole thing, you can add your actual address and then you can put the zip up for people to download. And then when they double click on it, it will have you preloaded as the person to contact.
Pre-configured, cool.
So it's quite useful if, for example, you're an investigative journalist who wants to have people contact you anonymously, you can say, this is, you know, run this program and talk to me.
Yeah. Yeah, and you host it somewhere in Iceland or something, right? I mean, it makes a lot of sense, actually. And, Tor, right, as a substitute for just regular internet kind of sucks, right? Because it's kind of slow because all sorts of people are using it for all sorts of nasty stuff, which is why they want to stay anonymous, like bad videos, bad stuff all around, right? But as a messaging platform, I'm imagining because the amount of data is so small, the latency issue probably isn't going to be too bad.
Right. Well, part of the issue with the latency is you're dealing with the speed of light. Like going through three hops in three different countries, it just is going to take time. If you're not actually waiting for a multi-megabyte file to download, that amount of time is less noticeable because it doesn't really add up. You know, it's multiplied by the amount of data that you're trying to get backwards and forwards. So it's not really a huge deal for a messaging platform. The other thing is we tend to look at messaging as very, very real time, but it's actually not. Right? As long as you can, you're not dealing with multi-minute lag. You know, if there's a three-hour lag between each messages, a hey, how you doing is, you know, not really going to work. But if it's less than a couple of seconds back and forth, it's absolutely fine. Right, that's very, very typical for how things work. Even a minute or two isn't a huge problem with a lot of messaging apps. So this huge focus on doing very, very, very low latency stuff, which of course makes traffic analysis easier, which provides more metadata that can be used. That I think that that's the wrong focus. People should assume that there should be a small amount of latency. You know, we can live with that. You know, adding latency isn't a huge problem that people think it is. It is in voice communications. It's not in text communications.
I got a final question here before we wrap it up, which is, again, on traffic analysis. Say I'm hosting this Tor hidden service. Is it possible, do you think, that, you know, you could see actual, you know, if someone was running a line intercept on me and they could see those packets coming in and my source is sitting somewhere inside the Australian government or the US government or wherever, right? And, or, you know, even from home, right? And there's a line intercept on them. I still imagine, though, if you would be able to tell that they're sending these types of packets through Tor to a hidden service or just to Tor, you'd be able to see them pop out that end and then pop in my end, right? So I imagine the last thing you'd really want to do to obscure this is to make sure you always had some Tor traffic ticking over, which would make the traffic analysis quite difficult.
Yeah, well, the problem is that the most of the Tor traffic that goes across is web traffic, and web traffic has a very, very specific sort of pattern. It's the client sends a very, very small amount of data, and the response comes back, so that's very, very large, which is different, of course, from a chat where the client and, in this case, the server, which would be the other client, of course, they each send a small amount of data back and forth. It's sort of a ping and response, you know, ping, echo, ping, echo, ping, echo. And so it looks on the wire very, very different from, you know, getindex.html. And that's, it's unfortunately, as far as I know, it's not possible to create masking traffic. So you wouldn't be able to do, for example, a torrent just constantly running in the background where you're feeding up Ubuntu.
Yeah, but if you were got a little bit complicated with it, you could. I mean, you could actually have a whole bunch of you know, dummy hidden services out there that would just, you know, you ping them with garbage and they ping you back and you sort of, you know, pseudo random it, and that would make it very hard.
Certainly. I mean, what if let's take your example where you have a source inside of the Australian government who has found some incredibly horrible thing that the Australian government is doing that's been documented, and they want to leak it to you. This is not beyond the realm of possibility. What you would want to do is you would want to have a Tor chat on a laptop or a device that is not linked to you. So in this case, it wouldn't be going over your home internet connection, possibly not even from the same town that you're in. And you would want to have your source inside of the government who has access to the classified materials, you'd want to have them send a signal that would say, okay, this Friday at 9 p.m., we will have our chat. So be available for our chat at 9 p.m. You know,
But then we're getting into all sorts of Watergate shit, right? Which is, you know, I'll mark the pot plant with an X, and I see exactly where you're going with it, right? But I guess, you know, the original basis of the conversation is, can we create secure IM so that a source can just fire it up, whack in an address, which they know is me, and just go, hey, man, we got to talk about some shit. And then you know, no problem, right. No recourse. And, you know, I think if we can solve the masking traffic problem, right, which wouldn't be a terrible problem, you know, I reckon we could actually get there. And that would, I mean, it would be both a fantastic and awful thing, but it's going to happen, right? Because everyone wants it since Snowden.
Right. So the I2P network, from what I understand, actually does solve that. And GNUNet definitely solves that, because part of the operation is that every client is always sending some amount of traffic. It's figured out that you do need that masking traffic, and it is part of the actual thing. So people really need to invest and make GNUNet work, because GNUNet actually does make things very, very difficult for metadata and traffic analysis.
So just to finish this off, because we are out of time, the idea that you could have a IM client that looks very much like Pigeon or Adium on Mac, or, you know, Trillion or whatever, or whatever, right? You can actually, yep, one day, maybe in 5 years from now, you will have an IM client there that's going to use anonymization technology and solid encryption that will be able to provide you with content security and defeat metadata analysis. It is possible.
It's possible today. It just crashes all the time. It's, you know, all it needs is money and investment of development resources. And, you know, the hard technical stuff has been solved already. It's just the...
It's the implementation, right? Yeah, it's making it pretty with little buttons and all that, and clicky pointy.
All the clicky clicky hasn't been done yet.
Yeah. All right. Well, Gruk, thank you very much for having a chat to us about secure messaging. I found it very, very interesting, and we'll chat to you again soon.
Always a pleasure, mate. Anytime.
The Gruk there with a look at secure messaging. And when I was talking about that directory idea, I was thinking about having, you know, you could actually list your status in a peer-to-peer messaging thing. But if you adjusted the client properly, you could just get it to connect to all of the hidden service addresses of your mates, and they could give you status information if you wanted. So this really does look like an issue or a problem that could be pretty easily solved. I can't wait for a secure chat plugin for something like Adium or Pigeon. I think something like that is going to be very, very popular. But moving on, and it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Jeffrey Mann, Tenable Network Security's PCI specialist. Tenable, as most of you would know, make vulnerability scanning and SIEM gear. So obviously a big market for them is the payment card security space. Well, that's what Jeff is mostly concerned with, but guess what? He sees, surprise, surprise, merchants doing some pretty crackheaded stuff out there in PCI land. And one of his pet peeves is when merchants try to use point-to-point encryption to dodge scope. He joined me via Skype to explain why he really doesn't like that idea.
Many, many companies, or what PCI calls entities, we can call them merchants, look at PCI and their approach is, how do I get this over with? What's the least amount of effort? What's the least amount of cost and resources? I just want to get this off my plate. And the most attractive way to get PCI off your plate is to take as much out of scope as possible to reduce or even eliminate any of your systems within your network, within your environment, from being considered in scope. And then you wave the rubber chicken and your PCI problems are solved.
Yeah, so that's why we've got things like tokenization, for example.
Correct, which is a good topic for another time.
Yeah.
I don't have much good to say about that either.
All right, well, let's get back to kicking point-to-point encryption. How is it actually used by merchants to try to dodge scope?
So a little bit of background is helpful, because I think this is a rabbit hole that the PCI Council actually kind of dug themselves and then jumped into. Quite a few years ago in the PCI world, somebody asked the question quite naturally, is encrypted cardholder data still cardholder data? And that became a hot topic, because the idea was, well, if it's not cardholder data, then we can take systems out of scope, because the council will say the litmus test for any system being in scope is whether there's card data present, and specifically the account number, what they call the PAN. So they came out with the idea, well, if it's encrypted, maybe it's not cardholder data. And a lot of big merchants kind of ran with that idea. And there were some early adopters that kind of came up with their own way of encrypting from the point of entry or the point of sale device, with the idea that if you take encrypted data through the network, and by the way, encrypting data throughout your internal network is not specifically a requirement, therefore it's an over and above, so hey, this is a great idea, this might take things out of scope. That went on for a little while. There were some adopters that kind of did it themselves and started making these claims, and at some point the council had to come out with a clarification statement which said to the effect that, well, if you're going to encrypt card data and you, the merchant, or what they call the entity, has no ability to decrypt that data, you know, so all you're looking at is encrypted data, and basically you don't have access to the keys so that you can decrypt it, then yeah, we could accept that it's not card data. But you can't have the ordinary methods for decrypting the data and getting back to a primary card number, and therefore you can call it not card data and call things out of scope. So for retailers, that was great. If you can encrypt out at your merchant location, your retail location, as close to the point of entry as possible, any system that's in between that swipe or that keypad entry all the way back through your corporate network onto the payment processors and banks, all those systems get magically taken out of scope. And, you know, right or wrong, mostly wrong, they take the merchants take that as a marching order to, hey, we don't have to do PCI.
Well, I mean, this strikes me as curious, given that some of the biggest payment card data heists in history have made use of RAM scrapers to actually get the numbers. And I'm guessing if you want to encrypt something with your wonderful new, you know, Acme POS 3.0 system, it's going to need to appear in clear text in memory at some point, right?
Yeah, so, yes, that and many other issues. You know, coming from a DoD background and being a cryptanalyst by classical training, I can tell you, you know, even the guys that do it for a living, that do it full time, have a hard time doing it. Encryption is really hard and really hard to do right, hard to implement, and key management, of course, becomes a big issue. So a lot of these homegrown systems or do-it-yourself systems were done very wrong.
So how far entrenched is this? Is this peer-to-peer encryption stuff? How commonly is it used? And I mean, is this something that was sort of ratified in the latest version of PCI? Because I understand there's a new version of PCI out, like a whole, whole version release has actually just happened recently. Has that added any clarification to this, or has it just made it worse?
Well, let me fill in a few more gaps, and then I'll answer that question, because there is this evolution. So the initial thing came out, yeah, if you encrypt it, you can count the data as not card data. Problem there becomes the fastest encryption systems are out there, symmetric cryptography. The key that you use to do the encryption is also the key that you use to decrypt. So if you've got a device in your possession out at your stores that's doing encrypting, guess what? You have the ability to decrypt because the key's in there. And
they're a little bit lazy with their tamper-proofing, right?
Well, so the next evolution is what was really the beginning of point-to-point encryption, where they said, okay, well, look, if you're going to do this, you've got to do the encryption in a firmware module, and it's got to be tamper-protected. And again, that's hard to do in the government world. I can't believe, and I still don't believe that it's done well in the commercial sector. But, you know, national governments, world governments are probably not going after the credit card data, so maybe there's a trade-off there. So that really is what evolved into what was originally a proposed standard of point-to-point encryption. And essentially, it's the only way that the PCI Council allows end-to-end encryption or point-to-point encryption to be used to effectively reduce all that scope that people want to reduce the scope of. And the standard it's been out for about a year, and they came up with a program where you could certify applications or components of applications, and then also total solutions. And there's on the PCI Council website, you can go and look up approved solutions and approved total component parts that could be used in solutions. And what prompted the blog was, after over a year, the very first solution was finally approved and put on the list. People have been out there looking at the list for literally over a year, waiting for that first solution to be approved. There's a lot of people trying to do it. I've had encounters as a QSA or a former QSA with other vendors trying to do it, and turns out they weren't following the rules as they were intended, which is do the firmware encryption. They were doing it in software. And guess what? You can break that. And they've had issues with that.
So in terms of PCI 3, is this something that features prominently in PCI 3?
Not really. I mean, version 3 of the standard isn't a whole lot different of version 2. The council believes that PCI as a security model or security framework is pretty comprehensive. And what most practitioners and naysayers and people that like to detractors of PCI like to look at is that there's not a lot of technical detail in terms of specific security requirements for new and emerging technologies. So the what comes up is cloud computing, virtualization, and the big one that nobody can get their arms around is mobile payments. So in some ways, P2PE is almost obsolete before it ever gets out there. The merchants that want to invest in it, they have to invest in brand new point of sale devices at all their retail locations, and that can be pretty extensive outlay of capital. They don't want to do that more than they have to. So I don't think there's going to be a lot of people that actually, you know, run out and try to buy the one approved solution. I'm sure there's a lot of companies out there that have used solutions that were advertised by the vendor as, oh, we're about to be compliant. I've heard anecdotally that that there's been some success of rolling it out in Europe, but I don't have any details on that. But I just don't see a lot of companies in the U.S. at least really buying into the technology.
So if it were up to you, what would you see happen with point-to-point encryption in the context of PCI? Would you like to see it removed as an option because it's so difficult to get right? I mean, would you just like to say, that's it? If you were say the PCI Council was replaced by Jeffrey Mann, PCI dictator, what would you do as dictator? Would you just say, no more point-to-point encryption?
I think it's great to do encryption if you're worried about the interception of the traffic in flight. But if you're going to do it and then rest on your laurels and think that you're fine, just like any other, you know, countless point solution that's been put out there in the world, in the security world in the last 15, 20 years, you know, there is no silver bullet. And just like anything else, point-to-point encryption is no silver bullet. It goes all the way back to Bruce Schneier's original book, Applied Cryptography, where he was going on and on about how encryption solved all the world's problems. And it's just a very simple thing. Just everything should be encrypted and you're done. I mean, he came back in his later book, you know, kind of with his tail between his legs, and he admitted, okay, I was kind of naive and young at the time. Encryption doesn't solve anything. So to answer your question, if you could do it and do it well, if you could trust the solution, yeah, it's great to have encryption. But to do it well, to do it correctly is so hard. And if you're, you know, choosing between that and some other tool that's going to help you in another way, I would just as soon you not do it.
Yeah, so using it as a checkbox way to escape scope, probably not the best way forward. Jeffrey Mann, thank you very much for chatting to us here at Risky Business.
Appreciate it, Pat. Thanks.
Jeffrey Mann of Tenable Network Security there with this week's sponsor interview. Big thanks to Tenable for its continued support of the Risky Business podcast. And that is it for another edition of the show. This week's track is by my old buddy, Simon Wright. I've mentioned before that I used to play in his band, but he moved away like 6 years ago. I played in his band for about 2 years, but he was in town last Friday night for a gig, and we played at a local venue here, The Rails, and good times were had by all. I sat in with his new band. They toured here from Melbourne, and his dad got up and had a play as well. It was great fun, and this song is a fun one to play and to listen to, I think, and it's called Rules of Attraction. I'll link through to the purchase page for this EP in the show notes. I think the whole EP costs something like $5. I hope you enjoy the song. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.
Just minding my business. Then she walked standing there in a black dress. She had it going on like a Hollywood actress. She couldn't find a pretty good girl with the actors. I swear, son of summer, got a hold of my wish list. Well, I gotta tell yo, people the Baptist. The game on Playboy, baby, get Baptist. She was like, it's all just the same. Ladies on the floor with the fellows. Yeah, let me tell you about this game. Rules of attraction as photos. Well, she whispered my name.
get up. So we jump off the stage. Found my feet taking me away. Tried to work up the courage to meet a friend in the Vista. Now that's better, but then I played it like I'd already met her.
Oh, come on.
Anyways, but we played it, we were back at the bar. She was out there smoking like a Cuban cigar. Now she don't mama leave it alone. Get her home. She was like, if it's all just the same, then it's on the floor with the bellows. Let me tell you about this game. The rules of attraction as follows. Well, she whispered my name. It was like, ooh, that would never be the same. All right, stop. I hit a bass funk. This game, the rules of attraction as follows. Well, whisper my name.